Okay. So welcome to GTI. GTI is the only and largest think tank in D.C. dedicated exclusively to Taiwan policy research. It is my distinct honor to welcome you all here to our second public seminar as part of a series that we are undertaking here to raise the visibility of Taiwan in the broader policy discussions here in Washington, D.C. To better enhance U.S.-Taiwan relations, we are undertaking three major programs here. We have a weekly publication that provides timely analysis about Taiwan policy relevant issues, this biweekly seminar series, and also an annual symposium. Before we start today's program, I'd just like to acknowledge a few of our distinguished attendees here today. We have our chairman, Dr. Robert Lai. He's over there. Thank you very much. And his support obviously makes, his leadership makes GTI possible. We also have our board member, Jennifer Hu, to include also several of our advisors, Dr. David Tsai and Dr. Chen Wenyan over there as well. So, and obviously I'll be remiss if I did not acknowledge the my staff, Anna and Melissa, who has made this this event possible. And of course, David, of course, who is a panelist right now with me. And Lily, of course. Where's Lily? I'm sorry, Lily is really the one, she's the backbone of the organization, and you know, really, we wouldn't have any Diet Cokes or Cokes here if it had not been for her. So, there are today's discussion will be focused on U.S.-Taiwan maritime cooperation. And there are really no shortage of events in 2006 that by themselves would be reason enough for a think tank to host an event on maritime issues in the Asia Pacific. And so clearly for a think tank focused on Taiwan, it is only fitting that we would organize an event on U.S.-Taiwan maritime cooperation. Some of these events that I would just highlight that I think necessitates the think tank to focus on this issue is one, of course, a new Taiwan president. President Tsai has, since coming into office, has highlighted a number of modernization programs that has focused on naval modernization, the Hague's permanent court of arbitration ruling, the PRC's continued efforts to build what PACOM Commander Admiral Harris has described as sandcastles in the sea, including Alex Sullivan and Ian Easton's reports, I would add, to the mix of important benchmarks on why we are organizing today's event. RIMPAC 2016. Also following what I would describe as, as a fact of what the Taiwan Defense Ministry had requested Google to blur out some satellite images of what appears to be structures in the northwestern shoreline of Taiping Dao, Ituapa. And so all this to say that it's been a very eventful year and surely more interesting months and months to come. And to really address all these issues and more about the current state and future of U.S.-Taiwan maritime cooperation, I'm very pleased to have and present our group of panelists here. To my immediate left is a dear friend and former colleague, Ian Easton. Ian is a research fellow at Project 2049 Institute, where he conducts research on defense and security issues in Asia. He worked as a China analyst at the Center for Naval Analysis and has been a visiting fellow at the Japan Institute for International Affairs. Ian holds an MA in China Studies from National Chung-Tsu University in Taiwan and a BA in International Studies from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. To his left, we have my friend and colleague, David Ahn. David Ahn was a East Asia Political Military Affairs Officer at the U.S. State Department for 6 years, beginning in 2009, prior to his fellowship at GTI, where he's currently serving as a Senior Research Fellow. Mr. Ahn was a Senior Project Manager for the THAAD Missile Systems at Lockheed Martin. He's currently engaged in PhD research on the political economy and security of East Asia. He holds an MA from the UC San Diego and a BA from UC Berkeley. Last but not least, to his left, we have Alexander Sullivan. We did not have the pleasure of really knowing one another prior to this event, although we did meet each other at an event last night, only after greeting and trying to brag about how long we've lived in D.C. to find out we're talking to one another, and that's sort of one of the things that happens often in Washington. But I've been a big follower of Alex's work at Center for New American Security. And so he's currently an adjunct fellow in the Asia-Pacific Security Program. He focuses on U.S.-China relations, maritime security, regional military modernization, and U.S. alliances, and the role of energy in geopolitics. So Mr. Sullivan has been widely published in U.S. international outlets. Prior to assuming his current position, he was an associate fellow at CNAS. He holds an MA in Chinese history from Columbia University and a BA from Columbia College. So we have a great deal of expertise today in keeping with the format of our public seminar series. This is going to be much more of a conversation than a sort of a presentation of sort. And so I prepared a set of questions that I will address to these individual speakers and encourage them to also engage with one another should they feel the urge to do so on questions that may be specifically directed to one person or the other. Ian, I want to start with you. I mean, obviously, because you're the closest one to me right now, so I'm going to put you on the spot here. Now, Ian, you wrote in one of your many papers, but one of the most recent ones on Taiwan's role in the naval rebalance to Asia, that Taiwan may be the single most underappreciated asset that the United States has for the rebalance to Asia. Can you explain for our audience here more fully why you think this is the case?
Well, first of all, Russ, thank you so much for the kind invitation. It is a pleasure and a privilege to be here. It is wonderful to see GTI do so well so quickly. I've been reading the briefs that you put out every week, and I just learned so much from that. I mean, it's just incredible. And it's a privilege to be in front of this audience because I look out and I see so many people who I've worked with over the years and so many friends. So it's just wonderful to be here. And thank you so much for having me. Now, I have written that Taiwan is an underappreciated asset, and it may be one of the most, if not the most, underappreciated asset, especially when we look at the pivot to Asia or the rebalance to Asia. And I think that's very true. It was true a year or 18 months ago when I wrote it, and I would argue it's still true to this day. If you look around the world today, and you think about threats to U.S. national security interests, I would say the three big ones, right? The first is China. The second is Russia. And the third is ISIS. And closely associated with ISIS is the threat of failed states. Now, of those three big threats, or to use perhaps a less alarmist term, of those big three challenges that we face as a country and that we're likely to face in the years ahead, for as far as the eye can see, China is the biggest one. And I think a big part of the pivot to Asia or the rebalance to Asia is actually about China. It's about the moves that China's made that have been aggressive, that have been expansionistic, that are destabilizing the region, the escalation and tension that we've seen. And if you look at Asia, out of all the countries that the United States, our country, could cooperate with, and could coordinate with, we're already doing pretty much everything we can with the Japanese, who are perhaps the most capable in the maritime domain. And we, I think, would like to do more with South Korea, but there are very real limits to what we can achieve with South Korea because South Korea is so preoccupied with its communist neighbor to the north. But with Taiwan, we don't even recognize that Taiwan exists. Officially, the United States government position is to treat Taiwan as if it's not even there. Officially, it's a non-entity. It's a country that we don't treat as a country. It's a government that we don't acknowledge as a government. And so when you think of it from that perspective, and when you look at all the capabilities that Taiwan has in the maritime domain, not just the naval capabilities, but the Coast Guard capabilities, if you look at Taiwan's maritime domain awareness, which is really just a way to describe in a comprehensive fashion naval intelligence. If you look at their maritime domain awareness capabilities, if you look at Taiwan's abilities in ballistic missile defense and in air defense. If you look at Taiwan's capabilities in sea denial, they far outstrip any other possible partner that the United States could have. But because we don't recognize Taiwan as a country, as a government, because we don't have official diplomatic relations, that makes everything so difficult. So even the basics, we don't do. We don't even have a 1.5 dialogue with Taiwan, or even a track 2.0 dialogue with Taiwan on maritime security issues. We don't do ship visits. We don't do senior level visits from PACOM or from the Pentagon. So I think there's just so much more that we could do, but we don't, because we are prevented by our fears of the unknown. Because we haven't done it for such a long time, since 1979, we're afraid of what doing it now, what might mean. And we're afraid to even think through what we're giving up by not doing it.
Thank you so much, Ian. I mean, and the thing with having such, you know, well-published analysts is that you get to pick at their reports and develop your questions from it. And so let me move quickly to Alex, actually, and probably help us sort of take a step back, because, you know, Ian, you really drilled into that question there, and that's great. But, you know, you've written also that no facet of the security relationship between the United States and Taiwan is more important than the maritime domain. Can you maybe sort of help elucidate on, you know, what this sort of, you know, what the assertion means and what, you know,
sure,
the scope of that is?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you so much for the invitation. I want to echo all of Ian's sentiments. You know, so glad to see GTI focusing attention on these very important issues and doing so well. I've been following your success closely and will continue to do so. And also happy to be here with many, you know, folks that I've worked with around town. Well, I think the answer to that is pretty simple. You know, first of all, Taiwan is an island nation, right? So if we're not going to prioritize maritime cooperation, I think that there's a very small, you know, our priorities would be skewed. And the United States, for its part, is, you know, a global maritime hegemon. You know, our we're trading. We are both, you know, highly dependent on trade. And for the United States part, you know, our global naval supremacy is a key facet of our strategic, you know, sort of grand strategy, you might say, going back 100 years to the Great White Fleet and even somewhat before that. So, you know, from the economic side and the military side, I think it sort of makes sense that maritime cooperation would be high on our list of issues to cooperate on. And then, you know, of course, the really pointed element in there is that if the mainland is going to try to reunite with Taiwan by force, the invasion is going to come by sea. So, you know, it will need to be a key element of our partnership for as long as the United States and Taiwan have a partnership, I think.
That's great, Alex. And moving back to you, Ian, I mean, something that you mentioned earlier, and that's why I'm going back before. I'm not trying to skip you, David. Don't worry. I mean, I'm gonna give you some questions. But you mentioned sea denial, Taiwan having a sea denial strategy. Since this is a conference about cooperation, cooperation in any domain necessarily entails complementary strategies. You and others have recommended, if you said, Taiwan employ a sea denial strategy. So what is the U.S. strategy to defend Taiwan?
Well, I think it's, I mean, that gets into a question of military planning. And so that I don't know. I'm not sure what the plan to defend Taiwan is. I'm a little more familiar with Taiwan's plan to defend itself, only because a lot of that plan is necessarily public information in Taiwan, where so many people are expected to contribute in the event of the supreme emergency. So I don't know what our strategy is. And actually, I don't know that we have a strategy. I think we have an operational plan or a concept of operations, but I don't think we have a strategy. I'm not sure that we do. I don't think we have a strategy for Asia.
Yeah.
And so if you don't have a strategy for Asia, and if you don't treat Taiwan like it even exists, and you have the U.S. Secretary of State and others going around the region and talking about, you know, all of our accomplishments and all of our bilateral relationships around the region, and then skipping right over Taipei mm-hmm. and Taiwan, mm-hmm. I really don't think we have a strategy, actually.
You know, I mean, that's a good sort of segue to David, actually. I mean, now, David, you know, the State Department, and you've served in the State Department, fairly or not, has a bad rap for being somewhat of an obstacle for cooperation between the United States and Taiwan. You served in the State Department. Do you think this is a fair assessment? What is the role of the State Department in U.S.-Taiwan maritime cooperation?
Sure. So first off, like my panelists, I want to thank Russell and GTI and the audience for the opportunity to be here to speak about these maritime issues. So yes, I was at the State Department as a political military officer for 6 years. I could share my personal views. I'm in no way a spokesperson on the current position of the State Department, so that's my caveat. But from my experience, yes, when I was at State Department, especially when you talk to DOD, there was a lot of concern, you know, blaming the State Department for being an obstacle for U.S. arms sales or various types of defense cooperation. However, just from my inside view, it was that the U.S. government, the State Department, tried to take a overall kind of all of government approach. So when I sat at State Department, I had the phone numbers and direct reach to White House, you know, AIT Taipei, AIT Washington, PACOM, OSD policy at the Pentagon. So we want to coordinate DHS, Homeland Security. We want to make sure that when we make a decision, it's going to be an all-of-government approach. So I think State Department does not necessarily have the luxury of taking a particularistic position, like, oh, we should just push this specific aspect of defense. So so with that said, there's all-of-government approach, and a lot of times it's in close coordination with the White House, right? So a second aspect is that the State Department's toolbox is a liberal toolbox of cooperation, various dialogues, various meetings. And with this, State Department is trying to maintain relevance and influence in the region. So the State Department needs to be careful about if we make certain policy decisions, what does that mean in a regional or geopolitical context with Taiwan's neighbors?
That's good. Well, you know, you kind of addressed this in your response already, but you know, maybe perhaps you can sort of expand on that a little bit more. And to highlight this is that, you know, it seems clear from both Ian and Alex's remarks that, you know, the military considerations for a stronger U.S.-Taiwan relationship is relatively clear. I mean, the threat from China, China to PLA, you know, the regional security balance. What are some of the, you know, the political considerations, and how would you, you know, advise proponents of a stronger U.S.-Taiwan defense relationship to overcome these sort of political considerations?
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons for defense cooperation. The reasons that might be the pull is what we have in mind: concerns over cross-strait relations, of course, the U.S.-China relationship. And also maritime sensitivities, especially if we're talking about territorial disputes, since today's topic is maritime cooperation with Taiwan, sensitivities with the South China Sea and the various, even Northeast Asia, Dokdo Island, Senkaku, Diaoyutai. These involve several different countries. So if I'm going to go into my talk, if you please one side, then you might be displeasing the other side. So that's an important policy consideration. In terms of moving forward with cooperation, Taiwan Relations Act provides justification for the U.S. to provide arms to Taiwan. That's an important mechanism for cooperation. And I'm also going to go into how, in my opinion, the most promising aspect of maritime cooperation between the U.S. and Taiwan would be through HADR, Humanitarian Assistance Disaster Relief. This provides a good political justification, save lives, disasters, for cooperation between different groups.
Well, you know, that's... you know, since David brought it up on sort of the South China Sea, and, you know, Alex, you wrote in your report, Navigating the Future, a great report, by the way, and I highly recommend everyone to, you know, go on CNAS's website and download it, that you wrote that you believe that the Taiping Island would be ruled as an island under Article 121 of the United Nations Convention of the Law of the Sea, UNCLOS. Why do you think the court ruled differently, and what are the implications?
Well, thank you. You're being overly generous about the report, but I have no idea why the court ruled the way they did, and I'm not qualified to comment on that aspect. I think, you know, it's fair to say that among those who follow these issues, it was widely expected that Taiping would, you know, had the best chance, at least, of being classified an island by the arbitral panel, but it wasn't. You know, that does make things, I think, a little bit confusing as to what the way forward is for Taipei, and then, you know, by extension for the United States. Obviously, these are very sensitive issues with, as David rightly pointed out, implications for all around the region for the U.S. bilateral relations, and you know, as well for Taiwan, which has to balance its desire to broaden its international space with, you know, with how it wants to proceed on territorial disputes. So, in many ways, the ideal scenario might have been that, you know, Taiping was Ituaba was declared an island and no other feature was, because Taipei then could have said, we relinquish all claims to anything other than Ituaba. And that would have made things a little bit simpler, but that didn't happen, so it's an irrelevant point anyway. So, you know, we've obviously seen where, you know, President Tsai has been on this issue thus far. Doesn't seem likely that relinquishing claims is in the cards. So it's, you know, it's a little difficult to see where that leads in terms of the legal resolution of these disputes. I don't think that anyone is expecting that there will be moves to try and revise Taiwan's occupation of Ituaba. I think I hate to be the American counseling the freeze, but I think you know, taking a slightly more cautious approach on you know, fortification of occupied features in the South China Sea is a wise course of action for all involved. I understand the pressures that make that seem like a difficult choice for everyone, but so I wish I had a better answer for you, but you can take it up with the Hague.
Well, yeah, no, I was going to say that maybe have the two other panelists also address that question too as well.
So Alex, if I heard you right, you don't like the idea of Taiwan putting a military garrison back on Ituaba. Is that right?
Well, I think circumspection is probably warranted at this point, because whatever garrison Taiwan is going to put on Ituaba is not it's not going to move the needle much on the actual military balance, in my inexpert estimation, and I would welcome your views if you think differently, and is politically clearly very, you know, these and anybody constructing facilities is at this point, you know, tends to contribute to tensions rather than relieve them. So, you know, I would not say Taiwan should forswear, you know, doing things on Taiping, but I think circumspection would be wise at this point. But, you know, welcome to hear your views on that issue.
Okay, well, I mean, first of all, I agree with you at the tactical level. And I also agree with you at the strategic level that if Taiwan were to unilaterally put Marines back on Ituaba and put anti-ship cruise missiles on Ituaba and put all the things that on Ituaba that arguably Ituaba really desperately needs for its own defense, if it were to do that unilaterally, I agree that that could drive a very real wedge between the U.S. and Taiwan at a time when we really don't need that wedge to be there. We never need a wedge between us. If anything, we need to be cooperating more closely together. However, from the American perspective, I actually think that my government should be encouraging Taiwan's government to put Marines back on Ituaba, not because it would make a large tactical difference, but because it sends a strong strategic signal. For the same reason that Jinmen and Matsu and Wuchouyu and Dongyin and the Penghus, all of these islands have strong military garrisons. Could any of them be defended in a full-on, all-out invasion over an extended period of time? The answer is no. That's not their purpose. That's not the reason you put garrisons on these islands. You put garrisons on these islands to make sure that they are not tempting targets, to make sure that the bad guys know that there will be very real costs, there will be bloodshed, if they try to come and take your territory away from you. That's why you do it. It complicates their planning assumptions. And that's why I think Taiwan is very wise to actually have strong garrisons in the outer islands and the Penghus. It's very wise because it really does, I believe, factor into, you know, as someone who reads a lot of PLA materials and writings, it does factor into their calculations. My concern is, 5 years from now, if there's a major crisis in the Taiwan Strait, and there very well could be, now we don't know when it will come, but I think all the trends would suggest that there could be a crisis at some point in the future if things keep going the way that they're going, and if Taiwan does not receive more support from the United States government, from the international community. When that crisis happens, the question becomes, is there any incentive for Beijing not to take Ituaba, or Pratas Island for that matter, in order to increase pressure on Taipei and to demoralize the ROC military? I would say today, no. A Coast Guard garrison has almost no deterrent effect at all. Now, if you put Marines on those islands, if you put missiles on those islands, if you make sure that you put on Ituaba the same types of platforms as the PLA is putting on Mischief Reef, for example, and some of the other major bases that they're building up, then you make sure that you're engaging in reciprocity, and you actually punish them for their destabilizing behavior while maintaining balance, not tactically, because you can't do that, but by maintaining some semblance of strategic balance and making sure that those islands do not become tempting targets in the next crisis. Because I would argue that today Ituaba is a very tempting target for political and strategic reasons because it's not well defended.
Wow. If I might offer some potential confounding points into that. I mean, it is excellent analysis, I think, overall. One, I think there's a difference to be made between, first of all, I should say that these views are my own. Everything I say here is my own view. It doesn't represent anyone else, certainly not the Center for New American Security or Georgetown University or whoever. I think there's a difference between the Outer Islands and Taiping, right? Because the Outer Islands are on the approaches to Taiwan, you know, that the PLA will likely use in the event of an invasion. Taiping is not. And every dollar that is spent on Taiping is a dollar that's not being spent, on Taiwan or on the approach, the likely avenues of invasion. So if it were cost indifferent, that's one thing. But we've seen that the Taiwan government has felt very cost constrained in terms of defense spending, as you well know. Given the fact that the morale point is something I have to think harder about, in the context of a potential crisis down the road, but in a purely military sense, and again, please, this is a somewhat inexpert opinion, but it seems to me that Taiping is more or less strategically indifferent to Taiwan, and that therefore. If anything, the PRC would welcome the expenditure of resources on Taiping, which is kind of out there in the South China Sea, versus on central concerns for Taiwan.
David, I want to put you on the spot right now, and I want you to wear two hats. Where one is as a purely just an analyst, and two, that of your former employer, the State Department, and that is and this is going to be complex, but I'm sure you can do this. You just heard Ian and Alex make a very sort of compelling point and counterpoint about the strategic value of Taiping Dal, and the military importance of Taiping Dal, or for Alex's argument, the lack of there, or lack thereof. But Ian made also a good point about the political implications of this. Can you wear so for you know sort of your State Department hat, your former State Department hat? Can you sort of outline sort of what are the political considerations, you know, that would that would either support or counter the importance of Taiping Dao in U.S. Taiwan relationship? And secondly, would be to also just you know sort of maybe factor in what would be the concerns that of Ian's recommendations that you know Taiwan basically re-garrisons you know the island. I know it's a long question, but
sure. So my personal views from the experiences with the Taiping situation that. The concerns are if Taiwan moves toward more kind of like heightens the military presence by having a Marine garrison, then on one hand it could be seen as exactly that heightening the Taiwan's military in the region, and then what are some regional reactions? Are other countries going to look at that and say, hey, Taiwan's stepping it up? The concern would be other countries might continue to step it up. But then Ian made a really good point, which is perhaps this is a move of Taiwan's response, Taiwan's reciprocity to other countries in the region already stepping it up, mm-hmm. right? So in that case, that could be the political justification. My view is that, you know, back when I was in the government, is that the government would want to, has an interest in preserving the peace. So the government generally, the U.S. government would generally recommend countries in the South China Sea area to not take provocative actions and to not heighten their military presence. So.
But this is all happening, and this is for the you know the rest of the panel also, and that is that this is all happening in the backdrop of you know what I said earlier with Pakon Commander describing Admiral Harris describing what China's doing in the South China Sea as sort of building sort of sandcastles in the sea. And you know it sort of continues unabated, and so I guess in this context, perhaps for you know again the three panelists here, you know what is Taiwan's role in sort of the naval dimension in the U.S. rebalance to Asia now, and you know the United States is engaging a lot more, you know phone ops operations and in the South China Sea. Can you address sort of what you sort of, in your obviously individual opinions, see as Taiwan's role in Taiwan in the naval dimension of U.S. rebalance to Asia? Do you want to start?
Oh, I'd be happy to.
Okay.
It's easy. Taiwan has no role.
But what do you see?
It certainly could. It could have a huge role to play. Mm-hmm. It has huge capabilities that are totally untapped by the United States government, mm-hmm. And those would include. Simple things. We could have a track 2 dialogue or a track 1.5 dialogue bilateral, U.S. and Taiwan, on maritime security issues in Asia. That would be a very simple and easy place to start. And then you could go from there. We could do arms sales to Taiwan that are related to the naval threats that Taiwan faces. We're not doing that. We have freezes on arms sales to Taiwan right now. The current administration, while it sold a lot, if you look at the dollar amount to Taiwan, it has not sold any of the key capabilities that Taiwan has long needed. And there's a long list, but these include, briefly, new fighter jets, new surface ships, new submarines, and new tanks for the Army. Or new, an alternative, if you don't like tanks, an alternative to the tank, some kind of MLRS system, like the ATACMS, a multiple launch rocket system, some kind of wheeled howitzer, anything like that for the Army. We've not done any of those things. And so as a result, Taiwan is increasingly starting to fall behind the PLA, not in terms of training, not in terms of quality, because Taiwan's military is a highly capable and highly professional military, unlike the PLA, which is not either. And not in terms of exchanges, because we have more exchanges with Taiwan, more training exchanges and other exchanges, but in terms of hardware. So that would be a place to start. We could do ship visits. We could do high-level visits. We could have, for example, the Deputy Assistant Secretaries of State for East Asia and of Defense for East Asia visit Taiwan. Currently, they're prohibited from doing so. We could have two-star admirals from PACOM visit Taiwan. Currently, they're prohibited from doing so, and they don't do so. And that would just be a starting point. We could lift the restrictions that we put on Taiwanese government officials to visit the United States. Currently, they're barred from coming to D.C. If President Tsai Ing-wen wanted to come to D.C. today, she couldn't. And I think that is, it's ridiculous. It's just breathtaking in terms of hypocrisy that we will not allow the leader, a democratically elected leader of a country as responsible and as supportive of the United States as Taiwan. It's incredible. The only conclusion that I can come to as an analyst is we're making all of our calculations based on fear and not on logic. Because if you look at it logically, this does not accord with our national interests and it does not accord with our principles as a nation. This is a policy made on fear because we don't know what China would do. And we do know that we want to appease China as much as we can because we think they might be crazy and attack somebody. And that's not a good place to make policy. And that kind of fog of fear. And I'm afraid that's what we're doing. So in terms of this question, there's so much more we could do. But to even start thinking about all the different initiatives that we could launch, and again, they could start very moderate, and very modest in size, and then grow over time and accumulate over time. But we're not doing that. We're just paralyzed. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's so much room for opportunity, and I think that's why this is a really fun topic to talk about.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
This is a big problem that we face, and unlike most big problems, there are a lot of potential solutions, I would argue, to this particular issue. That's